The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child, by Tom Hartman. Introduction on page 1, A New View for Our Children. Starts with a quote from Richard Klein and Blake Edgar. In the space of less than 40,000 years, ever more closely packed cultural revolutions have taken humanity from the status of relatively rare large mammal to something more like a geologic force. I was in India in 1993 to help manage a community for orphans and blind children on behalf of a German charity. During the monsoon season, the week of the big Hyderabad earthquake, I took an all-day train ride almost all the way across the subcontinent from Bombay through Hyderabad to Rajahmundry to visit an obscure town near the Bay of Bengal. In the train compartment with me were several Indian businessmen and a physician, and we had plenty of time to talk as the countryside flew by from sunrise to sunset. Curious about how they viewed our children diagnosed as having attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, I asked, "Are you familiar with those types of people who seem to crave stimulation yet have a hard time staying with any one focus for a period of time? They may hop from career to career and sometimes even from relationship to relationship, never seeming to settle into one job or into a life with one person. But the whole time they remain incredibly creative and inventive." "Ah, we know this type well," one of the men said, and the other three nodding in agreement. "What do you call this personality type?" I asked. "Very holy," he said. "These are old souls near the end of their karmic cycle." Again, the other three nodded in agreement, perhaps a bit more vigorously in response to my startled look. "Old souls?" I questioned, thinking that a very odd description for those whom American psychiatrists have diagnosed as having a particular disorder. "Yes," the physician said. "In our religion, we believe that the purpose of reincarnation is to eventually free ourselves from worldly entanglement and desire. In each lifetime, we experience certain lessons, until finally we are free of this earth and can merge into the oneness of God. When a soul is very close to the end of those thousands of incarnations, he must take a few lifetimes to do many, many things, to clean up the little threads left over from his previous lives." "This is a man very close to becoming enlightened," a businessman added. "We have great respect for such individuals, although their lives may be difficult." Another businessman raised a finger and interjected, "But it is through the difficulties of such lives that the soul is purified." The others nodded agreement. "In America, they consider this behavior indicative of a psychiatric disorder," I said. All three looked startled, then laughed. "In America, you consider our most holy men, our yogis and swamis, to be crazy people as well," said the physician with a touch of sadness in his voice. "So it is with different cultures. We live in different worlds. We in our Western world have such holy and nearly enlightened people among us, and we say they must be mad. But as we're about to see, they may instead be our most creative individuals, our most extraordinary thinkers, our most brilliant inventors and pioneers. The children among us, whom our teachers and psychiatrists say are disordered, may in fact carry a set of abilities, a skill set, that was necessary for the survival of humanity in the past, that has created much of what we treasure in our present quality of life, and that will be critical to the survival of the human race in the future. There is immense power in how we choose to view what's happening around us, and this is terrifically important when we consider how we can best know our children and provide them with the upbringing they need, an upbringing that will lead them to become happy, healthy, functioning adults. The premise of this book is that children who have what we have come to know as ADHD are important and vital gifts to our society and culture, and in the largest sense can be an extraordinary gift to the world. In addition, for those adults who have been similarly diagnosed or defined, this book offers a new way of understanding themselves and their relationship to the world, a way that brings insight, empowerment, and success. Genetics and differences. The long history of the human race, as we'll see in this book, has conferred on us, some of us more than others, a set of predilections, temperaments, and abilities carried through the medium of our genetic makeup. These skills were ideally suited to life in the ever-changing world of our ancient ancestors and, we have now discovered, are also ideally suited to the quickly changing modern world of cyberspace and widespread ecological and political crises that require rapid response. I will call this genetic gift the Edison gene, after Thomas Edison, who brought us electric lights and photographs and movies and literally 10,000 other inventions. He is the model for the sort of impact a well-nurtured child carrying this gene can have on the world. While I'm principally referring to the DRD4 gene, see chapter 5, the science of genetics is embryonic, with new discoveries being made every day. No doubt, sometime soon, we'll have a better, more complete list of specific genes that make up what Dave de Bronckart first called the Edison trait back in 1992, and Lucy Jo Palladino expanded on considerably in 97 in her wonderful book, The Edison Trait. For the moment, however, I'll use the useful shorthand of the Edison gene. When Edison's school teacher threw him out of school in the third grade for being inattentive, fidgety, and slow, his mother, Nancy Edison, the well-educated daughter of a Presbyterian minister, was deeply offended by the schoolmaster's characterization of her son. As a result, she pulled him out of the school. She became his teacher from then until the day he went off on his own to work for the railroads, inventing in his first months of employment a railroad timing and signaling device that was used for nearly a century. She believed in him and wasn't going to let the school thrash out of him his own belief in himself. As a result of that one mother's efforts, the world is a very different place. Ah, but we mustn't coddle these children, some say. Consider this. Edison invented, at age 16, that device that revolutionized telegraph communication. It started him on a lifelong career of invention that led to the light bulb, the microphone, the motion picture, and the electrification of our cities. Would the world have been better off if he'd been disciplined into behaving himself? The children and adults who carry this gene have and offer multiple gifts, both individually and as members of our society. Sometimes these gifts are unrecognized, misinterpreted, or even punished, and as a result, these exceptional children end up vilified, drugged, or shunted into special education. The result is that they often become reactive, sullen, angry, defiant, oppositional, and in extreme cases, suicidal. Some Edison gene adults face the same issues, carrying the wounds of the school with them into adulthood, often finding themselves in jobs better adapted to stability than creativity. What exactly defines those bearing this genetic makeup? Edison gene children and adults are by nature enthusiastic, creative, disorganized, non-linear in their thinking, they leap to new conclusions or observations, innovative, easily distracted, or to put it differently, easily attracted to new stimuli, capable of extraordinary hyperfocus, understanding of what it means to be an outsider, determined, eccentric, easily bored, impulsive, entrepreneurial, energetic. All of these qualities lead them to be natural explorers, inventors, discoverers, leaders. Those carrying this gene, however, often find themselves in environments where they're coerced, threatened, or shoehorned into a classroom or job that doesn't fit. When Edison gene children aren't recognized for their gifts, but instead are told that they're disordered, broken, or failures, a great emotional and spiritual wounding occurs. This wounding can bring all sorts of problems for children, for the adults they grow into, and for our society. I and many scientists, educators, physicians, and therapists believe that when these unique children don't succeed in public schools, it's often because of a disconnect between them, their brains are wired to make them brilliant inventors and entrepreneurs, and our schools, which are set up for children whose brains are wired to make them good workers in the structured environments of a factory or office cubicle. Those children whom we call normal are more methodical, careful, and detail-oriented and are less likely to take risks. They often find it hard to keep it together and perform in the rapid-fire world of the Edison gene child. They don't do as well with video games, couldn't handle working in an emergency room or on an ambulance crew, and seldom find themselves among the ranks of entrepreneurs, explorers, and salespeople. Similarly, Edison gene children have their own strengths and limitations. They don't do well in the school environment of repetition, auditory learning, and rote memorization that has been set up for normal kids, and they don't make very good bookkeepers or managers. Genetically, these kids are pioneers, explorers, and adventurers. They make great innovators, and they find high levels of success in any field where there's a lot of change, constant challenge, and lots of activity. Such personalities are common among emergency room physicians, surgeons, fighter pilots, and salespeople. There are many areas in which such people can excel, especially when they make it through childhood with their belief in themselves intact. 1993, the Hunter gene. Dozens of studies over the years have demonstrated that ADHD is genetically transmitted to children from their parents or grandparents. From the 1970s, when this link was first discovered, until 1993, when my first book on the topic was published, conventional wisdom held that ADHD, hyperactivity, and the restive need for high stimulation were all indications of a psychiatric illness that should be treated with powerful, mind-altering, stimulant drugs. But it could be that ADHD, this psychiatric illness, has a positive side. I proposed in 1993 that these behaviors and temperaments, often misunderstood in schools, were once, in fact, useful skills for hunter-gatherer people, which throughout the book I'll refer to simply as hunters. And also have a place in the modern world of emergency rooms, police departments, entrepreneurial businesses, and sales, to which the skills of the hunter can be transferred. A year later, the metaphor entered the popular culture with a Time magazine cover story on ADD and a sidebar article about my hypothesis titled, "Hail the Hyperactive Hunter." Here's a chart from my first book, Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception, that broadly summarized my 1992 view of attention deficit disorder, ADD, and that contrasts this hunter skill set with the skills of the very first farmers or agriculturists, which have become those most favored in our schools and most workplaces. The hunter versus farmer view of ADHD. So there's a column of trait as it appears in the disorder view, trait as it appears in the hunter view, opposite farmer trait in the third column. So the first trait as it appears in the disorder view short attention span, which can become intensely focused for long periods of time. As a hunter, this is constant monitoring of the environment. The opposite farmer trait would be that attention is not easily distracted from the task at hand. The disorder view, poor planning, disorganization, impulsivity, tendency to make snap decisions. Hunter, ability to enter the chase on a moment's notice. Farmer, ability to sustain a steady, dependable effort. Disorder, distorted sense of time, lack of awareness of how long it will take to do something. Hunter, flexibility, a readiness to quickly change strategy. Farmer, purposeful organization, long-term strategy that's adhered to. Disorder, impatience. Hunter, tirelessness, the ability to sustain drive, but only when hot on the trail of some goal. Farmer, awareness of time and timing. Tasks are completed in time, on pace, and with good staying power. Disorder, inability to convert words into concepts and vice versa. Learning disability may or may not be present. Hunter, visual/concrete thinking. Clear sight of a tangible goal, even if there are no words for it. Farmer, patience, an awareness that good things take time, a willingness to wait. Disorder, difficulty following directions. Hunter, independence. Farmer, playing on a team. Disorder, daydreaming. Hunter, becoming bored by mundane tasks, enjoying new ideas, excitement, the hunt, or being hot on the trail. Farmer, focusing on follow-through, tending to details and taking care of business. Disorder, acting without considering consequences. Hunter, willingness and ability to take risks and face danger. Farmer, taking care to look before you leap. Disorder, lacking in social graces. Hunter, no time for niceties when there are decisions to be made. Farmer, nurturing, creating and supporting community values, attuning to whether something will last. Of course, when I referred to farmers in my comparison, I wasn't talking about modern agriculturists who contend with all the equipment and challenges of agriculture today. Instead, I was considering the skill set of the first settled people who engaged in agriculture, those who had to spend hour after hour planting, cultivating, and harvesting crops by hand. To engage in such early farming activity, three basic behaviors, which we now know are genetically determined and are related to brain dopamine levels, three basic behaviors would have to be minimized: distractibility, impulsivity, and risk-taking. These three behaviors, however, would have been assets to hunters. Because they are at the core of the ADHD diagnosis and relate to those with the Edison gene, these behaviors are worth briefly exploring, although with their history, along with their history in human societies. Here's a summary adapted from the one I included in my book, ADD Success Stories, that's still quite apt. Distractibility. Distractibility is often incorrectly characterized as the inability of a child or adult to pay attention to a specific task or topic. Yet, people with ADHD can pay attention even for long periods of time. It's called hyperfocusing, but only to something that excites or interests them. It's a cliche, but true, that there is no ADHD in front of a good video game. ADHD experts often noted that it's not that those with ADHD can't pay attention to anything, it's that they pay attention to everything. A better way to characterize the distractibility of ADHD is to describe it as scanning. In a classroom, the child with ADHD is the one who notices the janitor mowing the lawn outside the window, instead of focusing on the teacher's lecture on long division. Likewise, the bug crawling across the ceiling or the class bully preparing to throw a spitball is infinitely more fascinating than the teacher's analysis of Columbus's place in history. But while this constant scanning of the environment is a liability in a classroom setting, it may have been a survival skill for our prehistoric ancestors. A primitive hunter who couldn't easily fall into a mental state of constant scanning would be at a huge disadvantage. That flash of motion on the periphery of his vision might be either the rabbit that he needed for lunch, or the tiger or bear hoping to make lunch of him. If he were to focus too heavily on the trail, for example, and therefore miss the other details of his environment, he would either starve or be eaten. When the agricultural revolution began 12,000 years ago, however, this scanning turned into a liability for those people whose societies changed from hunting to farming. If the moon was right, the soil held the perfect moisture, and the crops were due to be planted, a farmer couldn't waste his time wandering off into the forest to check out an unusual movement he noticed. He had to keep his attention focused on the task at hand and not be distracted from it. Impulsivity. Impulsivity has two core manifestations among modern people with ADHD. The first is impulsive behavior, acting without thinking things through, or the proverbial leap before you look. Often this takes the form of interrupting others or blurting things out in conversation. Other times it's reflected in snap judgments or quick decisions. To the prehistoric hunter, impulsivity was an asset because it provided the ability to act on instant decisions as well as the willingness to explore new, untested areas. If the hunter were chasing a rabbit through the forest with his spear and a deer ran by, he wouldn't have time to stop and calculate the risk-benefit analysis. He would have to make an instant decision about which animal to pursue, then act on that decision without a second thought. Thomas Edison eloquently described how his combined distractibility and impulsiveness helped him in his hunt for world-transforming inventions. He said, quote, "Look, I start here with the intention of going there," drawing an imaginary line, "in an experiment, say, to increase the speed of the Atlantic cable. But when I have arrived part way in my straight line, I meet with a phenomenon and it leads me off in another direction to something totally unexpected," unquote. The second aspect of impulsivity is impatience. For a primitive farmer, however, impatience and impulsivity would spell disaster. If he were to go into the field and dig up the seeds every day to see if they were growing, the crops would die. Parentheses, a contemporary manifestation of this is the person who can't leave the oven door shut, but has to keep opening it to check how the food's doing, to the detriment of many a soufflé. A very patient approach, all the way down to the process of picking bugs off plants for hours each day, day after day, would have to be hardwired into the brain of a farmer. The word boring couldn't be in his vocabulary. His brain would have to be built in such a way that it tolerated or even enjoyed sticking with something until it was finished. Risk-taking. Risk-taking, or as Dr. Edward Halliwell and Dr. John Rattay describe it in their book, Driven to Distraction, a restive search for high stimulation, is perhaps the most destructive of the behaviors associated with ADHD in contemporary society. It probably accounts for the high percentage of people with ADHD among prison populations and plays a role in a wide variety of social problems, from the risky driving of a teenager to the infidelity or job hopping of an adult. Yet, for a primitive hunter, risk and high stimulation were a necessary part of daily life. If a hunter were risk or adrenaline averse, he'd never go into the wilds to hunt. For a hunter, the idea of daily risking his life would have felt normal. In fact, The urge to experience risk, the desire for that adrenaline high, would have been necessary among the members of a hunting society, because it would have propelled their members out into the forest or jungle in search of stimulation and dinner. If a farmer were a risk-taker, however, the results could lead to starvation. Because decisions made by farmers had such long-ranging consequences, their brains would have to have been wired to avoid risks and to carefully determine the most risk-free way of going about his work. If a farmer were to decide to take a chance and plant a new and different crop, ragweed, for example, instead of the wheat that grew so well the previous year, the result might have led to tragic dietary problems for the tribe or family. That genetic predispositions to behavior can be leftover survival strategies from prehistoric times is a theme most recently echoed in a Time magazine cover story on the brain. The article pointed out that the craving for fat among some people in parts of the world that experienced famine ensured the survival of those who were able to store large quantities of this nutrient under their skin. Quote, but the same tendencies cause mass heart failure when expressed in a fast food world, unquote, the authors point out. Even the genetic inclination to alcoholism may have positive prehistoric roots, according to evolutionists Randolph Neese and George Williams in their book Why We Get Sick. The persistence of an alcoholic in the face of social, familial, and biological resistance and disaster, they say, reflects an evolutionary tendency to go after neurochemical rewards despite obstacles. This tenacity may in some way be responsible for the continued growth, survival, and evolution of our species. So the agricultural revolution highlighted two very different types of human societies, farmers and hunters. Each group lived different lives in different places. Those with the ADHD gene in farming societies were probably culled from the gene pool by natural selection, or they became warriors for their societies, hunting other humans as various tribes came into conflict. In some societies, evolving into the countries of Japan and India, for instance, this role was even institutionalized into a caste system. History is replete with anecdotes about the unique personalities of the warrior caste, such as the Kshatriya in India and the samurai in Japan. Where have all the hunters gone? If we accept for a moment the possibility that the gene that causes ADHD was useful in another time and place, but has become a liability in our modern society based on the systems of agriculture and industry, then these questions arise. How did we reach a point in human evolution where the farmers so massively outnumber the hunters? If the hunter gene was useful for the survival of people, why have hunting societies largely died out around the world, and why is ADHD seen in only 3-20% of the population, depending on how you measure it and whose numbers you use, instead of a 50% or more? Recent research from several sources shows that hunting societies are always wiped out by farming societies over time. Fewer than 10% of the members of a hunting society normally survive when their culture collides with an agricultural society, and it has nothing to do with the hunter's attention deficits or with any inherent superiority of the farmers. In one study reported in Discover magazine, the authors traced the root languages of the peoples living throughout Central Africa and found that at one time the area was dominated by hunters. The Khoisans and the Pygmies. But over a period of several thousand years, virtually all of the Khoisans and Pygmies, the Hottentots and the Bushmen, as they've been referred to in Western literature, were wiped out and replaced by Bantu-speaking farmers. Two entire groups of people were rendered nearly extinct, while the Bantu-speaking farmers flooded across the continent, dominating Central Africa. There are several reasons for this startling transformation. First, agriculture is more efficient at generating calories than hunting. Because the same amount of land can support up to 10 times more people when used for farming rather than hunting, farming societies generally have roughly 10 times the population density of hunting societies. In war, numbers are always an advantage, particularly in these ratios. Few armies in history have survived an onslaught by another army 10 times larger. Second, diseases such as chickenpox, influenza, and measles, which virtually wiped out vulnerable populations such as native North and South Americans, who died by the thousands when exposed to the illnesses of the invading Europeans, began as diseases of domesticated animals. The farmers who were regularly exposed to such diseases developed relative immunities. Though they would become ill, these germs usually wouldn't kill them. However, those with no prior exposure and thus no immunity often would die. So when farmers encountered hunters, the latter were often killed off simply through exposure to the farmer's disease. Finally, agriculture provides physical stability to a culture. The tribe stays in one spot while their population grows, which allows its members to specialize in individual jobs. Some people become tool and weapon makers. Some build devices that can be used in war, and some create governments, armies, and kingdoms, all of which give farming societies a huge technological advantage over hunting societies, which are generally more focused on day-to-day survival issues. So now we have an answer to the question, where have all the hunters gone? Most were killed off, from Europe to Asia, from Africa to the Americas. Those who survived were brought into farming cultures either through assimilation, kidnapping, or cultural change, and provided the genetic material that appears in the small percentage of people with ADHD today. Further evidence of the anthropological basis of ADHD is seen among the modern survivors of ancient hunting societies. Indigenous hunters today. Cultural anthropologist Jay Fikes, Ph.D., points out that members of traditional Native American hunting tribes normally behave differently from those who have traditionally been farmers. The farmers, such as the Hopi and the other Pueblo Indian tribes, are relatively sedate and risk-averse, he says, whereas the hunters, such as the Navajo, are constantly scanning their environment and are more immediately sensitive to nuances. They're also the ultimate risk-takers. They and the Apaches were great raiders and warriors. A physician who recently read my first book and concluded that he saw proof of the hunter versus farmer concept in his work with some of the Native Americans in Southwest Arizona dropped me the following unsolicited note over the internet. Many of these descendants of the Athabascan Indians of Western Canada have never chosen to adapt to farming. They had no written language until an Anglo minister, fairly recently, wrote down their language for the first time. They talk heart to heart, and there is little clutter between you and them when you are communicating. They hear and consider everything you say. They are scanning all the time, both visually and auditorily. Time has no special meaning unless it is absolutely necessary. That's something we Anglos have imposed on them. They don't use small talk, but get right to the point and have a deep understanding of people and the spiritual. And their history shows that they have a love of risk-taking. Will Crinan, M.D., noted the same differences when he worked for the Canadian government as the physician for several Native North American tribes and during the years he worked as a physician for the Red Cross in Southeast Asia. After reading my first book, he wrote, I've worked among indigenous hunting societies in many parts of the world, from Asia to the Americas. Over and over again, I see among their adults and children that constellation of behaviors we call ADD. In those societies, however, these behaviors are highly adaptive and actually contribute to the society's success. Among the members of the tribes of northern Canada, such as the caribou hunters of the Mackenzie Basin, these adaptive characteristics, constantly scanning their environment, quick decision-making, impulsivity, and a willingness to take risks, contribute every year to the tribe's survival. These same behaviors, however, often make it difficult for tribal children to succeed in Western schools when we try to impose our Western curriculum on them. But what sent humankind onto the radical social departure from hunting to farming? Few other animals, with the exception of highly organized insects such as ants, have developed a society that is based on anything that approaches agriculture. In The Ascent of Man, Jacob Bronowski points out that 20,000 years ago, every human on Earth was a hunter and forager. The most advanced hunting societies had started following wild herd animals, as is still done by modern Laplanders. This had been the basis of human and pre-human society and lifestyle for several million years. Until 1995, the earliest hard evidence of human activity, and hunting activity at that, came from the Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania, Africa, with fragments of stone tools and weapons that dated back 2.5 million years. More recently, University of Southern California anthropologist Craig Stanford is quoted in the Chicago Tribune as saying that recent research he conducted in Africa indicates that early hominids may have been tribally hunting as early as 6 million years ago. So, for 6 million years, our ancestors were hunters, and then suddenly, in a tiny moment of time, 10,000 years is to 6 million years, what less than 3 minutes is to a 24-hour day, the entire human race veered in a totally new direction. The Agricultural Revolution. The reason for the change, according to Bronowski and many anthropologists, probably has to do with the end of the last ice age, which roughly corresponds to the beginning of the agricultural revolution. Bronowski and most authorities place the agricultural revolution as occurring roughly 12,000 years ago. At that time, mutated grasses appeared simultaneously on several continents, probably in response to the sudden and radical change in climate. These grasses were the first high-yield, edible ancestors of modern rice and wheat, and provided the humans who lived near them an opportunity to nurture and grow these staple foods. These people, with the farmer-like patience to grow crops, evolved into farming societies that emptied their ranks of the impulsive, sensation-seeking hunters among them. Those persons who were not patient enough to wait for rice to grow maintained their hunting tribes, the last remnants of which we see today in a few remaining indigenous peoples on the earth. The Old Testament, for example, is in large part the story of a nomadic hunting tribe moving through the wrenching process over several generations of becoming a settled farming tribe. Our society's hunters. A year after the Time magazine article, the idea of ADHD as a positive condition hit the business press when former Inc. magazine publisher, entrepreneur, and author Wilson L. Harrell wrote in his book For Entrepreneurs Only, in his column for Success magazine, "For two decades I have wrestled with a provocative question. Are entrepreneurs born or made? I've always contended that they are made, anyone can become one, but I've never been entirely satisfied with that answer. There's that nagging fact that entrepreneurial parents tend to have entrepreneurial children, There's the unexplained truth that entrepreneurs' personalities are different from other people's. Harold describes reading about my hunter versus farmer hypothesis and says, "There's still a lot of hunter left in our genes and in our hearts. In a world dominated by farmers and corporate types, there are plenty of full-blooded hunters trying to hunt for a living. Those, my friend, are entrepreneurs. Hunters and those with ADD are accordingly similar. I suspect most entrepreneurs, if they sat still long enough, could be diagnosed as having ADD, and I've passed my ADD, or hunter, genes to my children." In 1996, the Journal of Genetic Psychology published an article titled "Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, an Evolutionary Perspective," in which they suggested that, quote, "Although no theory entirely explains the occurrence of ADHD, it is worthwhile to note that at least historically, ADHD may have served an adaptive function and may have been selected by the environment for survival," unquote. In 1997, Peter Jensen, M.D., the head of the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Division of the National Institute of Mental Health, was the lead author of a paper published in the peer-reviewed Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. In that paper, titled "Revolution in Evolution, ADHD as a Disorder of Adaptation," he and his co-author strongly argued that ADHD children shouldn't be told they have an illness, but that instead parents and teachers should emphasize their positive characteristics. Quote, "In reframing the child who has ADHD as response-ready, experience-seeking, or alert," they wrote, "the clinician can counsel the child and family to recognize situations in modern society that might favor such an individual, both in terms of school environments as well as future career opportunities, for example, athlete, air traffic controller, salesperson, soldier, or entrepreneur," end quote. But it was all just speculation until 2000. When the article "Dopamine Genes and ADHD" appeared in Neuroscience and Behavioral Reviews. This paper, by lead author Dr. James M. Swanson and 10 other scientists, noted that, quote, "The literature on these candidate genes and ADHD is increasing. 8 molecular genetic studies have been published so far about investigations of a hypothesized association of ADHD with the DAT1 and the DRD4 gene," unquote. Soon, other scientists were saying the hunter gene may be a good thing. For example, Dr. Robert Moises said of an NIMH-funded study, that's National Institute of Mental Health, funded study of the gene, which he helped conduct, quote, "We found a significant positive selection for the genetic variation associated with ADHD and novelty-seeking behavior in the human genome. This study strengthens significantly the connection between genetic variations and ADHD. It also provides a clue as to why ADHD is so pervasive," unquote. Numerous other scientific journals over the years have published similar reports or studies. There's a growing consensus that such children are carrying a gene for a behavior set that's really a skill set, a collection of useful adaptations. And a growing number of voices, such as Howard Gardner, Frames of Mind, The Theory of Multiple Intelligences, and Daniel Goleman, Emotional Intelligence, Why It Can Matter More Than IQ, are calling for a wider definition of the kinds of intelligence and talent our schools accept and teach to. Scientists who have studied human DNA have found that the appearance of this gene variation coincided with many of the larger migrations of humans around the world. Researchers have tracked this gene, which they had previously thought of as causing a disorder, back to a time when it was a gene that caused behaviors necessary for human survival. It may even have been the gene responsible for both the spread of humanity across the globe and the flowering of civilization and modern culture. For all we know, without this curiosity gene driving exploration and invention, humans might still be splitting flints and warming themselves around open fires. The Edison gene. All these discoveries have led me to a new hypothesis built upon my earlier work with the hunter-farmer model. The early development of this came in part from Michael Garnatz, who, with his wife Heidi, has founded and runs the website www.hypies.com. That's HYPIES.com. In Berlin, Germany, one of the largest and most well-known ADHD sites in Germany. Michael confronted me one day with the essential inconsistency of a theory that suggests the Edison gene, which emerged in full form only about 40,000 years ago, was useful for hunters when humans had been hunters for 100,000 years before that. Although I'd never called it a farmer gene, Michael pointed out that its emergence in the human genome seemed to coincide with some of the earliest documented examples of ancient peoples experimenting with agriculture. So how could I continue to call it the hunter gene? I thought about this for some time, trying to figure out how to put together all the pieces in a way that was scientifically consistent and not merely some glib renaming of an older theory. Nothing seemed to work. And then I read William Calvin's new book, A Brain for All Seasons. Calvin had synthesized some of the most remarkable science of the last decade of the 20th century and had done so in a way that gave sudden and clear meaning to the appearance and persistence of the Edison gene. The class survival gene. It's amazing what science can learn in a decade. In the early 1990s, most paleoclimatologists believed that climate change was a gradual phenomena, and that ice ages lasting 10,000 or more years were gradually alternated with periods of warmth. Nobody understood what caused the ice ages or even our current warmth, although variations in solar radiation were suspected. Similarly, paleoanthropologists had known for decades that fully modern humans emerged from Africa about 200,000 years ago, and about 40,000 years ago began behaving in highly organized and cooperative ways. Scientists had figured out that if they could take a child from the world of 38,000 years ago and raise him in today's world, he would be indistinguishable from the rest of us. The problem was that nobody could understand why it took these modern people so long, up until about 10,000 years ago, to begin building city-states and engaging in intensive agriculture. Of course, people pointed to the Ice Age that had North America, Northern Asia, and Europe in its grip until 10,000 years ago, but this didn't explain why civilizations weren't being built in still warm Africa or other equatorial areas of the world. In part, this confusion was due to the common assumption that ice ages were a relatively constant phenomenon that had come on slowly throughout ancient history, with the glaciers of the most recent one gradually melting around 10,000 years ago, leading to today's weather. A decade later, however, scientists discovered that what they thought to be true was actually wrong. As William Calvin documents so brilliantly in A Brain for All Seasons, it turns out that each and every one of the transitions between the cold, dry, windy ice ages and today's wet, warm weather happened not gradually over hundreds or thousands of years, but suddenly in fewer than a dozen years. The weather might have become strange one year with a cold summer and a hard winter, and then the next year, or the one after that, the summer simply never returned. The winters then became so harsh that very few humans could survive them, with the exception, it seems, of the Neanderthals, who could and did more easily because their bodies were better adapted to cold. Although ice gripped the north during these times, the weather changes also hit Africa and southern Asia. When it became cold in the north, drought struck the equatorial regions. Water holes dried up, rivers stopped flowing, jungles and rainforests turned to tinder and then blazed in massive, continent-wide, continent-consuming wildfires. When, 1,000 or so years later, the worldwide weather switched to being wet and warm, ice in the north thawed and monsoon-like floods swept Africa, tearing away what life had managed to hang on to, survival during the cool, dry, windy period. This is the cauldron in which humans evolved. When we look at a graph of worldwide temperatures, we discover that in the past 150,000 years, virtually the whole of human history, there has rarely been a period of 10,000 years, or even as much as 2,000 years, of steady, warm, comfortable weather. The single exception is the past 10,000 years, which was referred to as the Holocene period. Hunters before the Holocene. When the climate is stable, farmers are at an advantage. During the summer, they can plant and harvest crops, which they can eat during the winter. Life is good, and they're able to extract at least 10 times the calories from a given area of land that hunter people can. However, when the climate is constantly changing, farming becomes impossible. Hunters rarely suffer from the affliction of farmers, famine, because when a hunting area is hit by drought or flood, heat or cold, such people simply move to another place. When one primary food plant or animal dies off, they switch to others. When the pickings get slim, hunters expand their range. The diet of hunters is incredibly diverse because of their ranging and nomadic existence. This is why, until the development of antibiotics around the time of World War II, no agricultural peoples in the 8,000-year history of agriculture had achieved the health of hunters. Both modern and ancient hunters consistently have had stronger bones and taller bodies, have lost fewer teeth, and have lived longer than typical Europeans from the earliest cities as recently as 50 years ago. While popular culture portrays the lives of hunter people as harsh and miserable, the ones I've met and known on four continents enjoy high-quality lives. Indeed, according to anthropologists, hunters represent the original leisure society, typically working only 2 to 4 hours a day to secure all their food and shelter needs, and spending the rest of the time playing with their families, talking, singing, and building community. Dr. Robert Wolf wrote one of the best books on this, titled Original Wisdom, about his time with the Singoi hunter people of Malaysia. Side note, I highly recommend that book, Original Wisdom. Adapted to adversity and change. Thus, we find that hunters were ideally suited to the climate of the world for most of its history, just as agricultural peoples are well suited to it as it is today. In both of these cultures, there is and has always been a place and a need for those nonconformist, creative individuals who are best adapted to change, especially when the climate undergoes one of its regular flip-flops, to use Calvin's term. During ancient hunter times, it was the creative nonconformists who broke with 100,000 years of tradition and invented ostrich shell beads to exchange with other tribes as a way of sealing mutual deals for hunting rights. During more recent agricultural and industrial times, it was the creative nonconformist Thomas Edison who brought us electric lights, movies, and 1,000 other inventions. The gene for wanderlust, adventure, and innovation is relatively rare, carried by fewer than 10% of our population. But it's incredibly valuable, and it's even possible that one day the survival of the human race will depend on it. It certainly has in the past.